Welcome, welcome, welcome to the Limitless, the podcast between the sweet Jason Halsley. I am talking to Eileen Mayer, a singer-songwriter and translator of the infinite, and not alien abductee, but something that we will explore as you listen. Come this far. Oh, well, that's a great way to start the podcast.
Can I just tell you that? It's just so refreshing and wow, he sees so much and weaves it all together so beautifully. I'm just in awe of that. I write a lot of words and I talk a lot, but I've never felt like I had that skill of, you know, being a master weaver of words, and ideas,
Well, thank you. It's come, as I suspect our conversation was coming at a good time for me, because I've been in a real valley or a slump last couple of weeks, probably along with millions of other people, I suspect. But anyway, it's been a rocky past few days. Yeah. And so it's good to receive some encouragement.
I'm happy to do it.
Thanks. And specifically around, I mean, there's more to this, of course, and more to everything. Because specifically you picked up on the Prisoner Infinity thing, and because of your own experiences with whatever, maybe the thing we're going to get into today.
Beyond that too, yeah. But that was just something that just kind of went, oh my God, we really connect on this. So I'm excited about proceeding into that, yes. And there's more, yeah.
I'm sure there is, as I say, and that it doesn't have to be the focus, but the reason I brought it up was because, and I don't know what I said in that interview that you listened to, of course, but maybe one of the things I said, or maybe one of the things you picked up on, is that this whole thing around, actually, I don't even know how, what we're going to call it, but specifically the visitors and the Whitley Strieber thing, but what's underneath that and around that, just this whole subject, and I was going to start by saying, you know, higher dimensional transcendental realities and stuff, because that's where I really want to get to. But the whole thing, my whole relationship with it has been very fraught, and I've had to kind of close the door on it. Like Prisoner Infinity was my way of closing the door on it, in a certain sense. It's that saying, that famous saying, Philip K. Dick, if you stop believing in everything, then what's left is going to be real. That's what I had to do with this experience. Yeah. I just had to stop believing in it. And because I believed in it so deeply, I had to meet belief with disbelief. I had to take a position of disbelief. But I have tried to say on some of these conversations, and probably the one you listen to, that I don't actually close the door. It's like a self-stalking, which is a Castaneda phrase, which is another door that I had to close, where I have to, I don't know if trick myself is the word, but I suppose it's letting go, but I have to, I really have to test something so thoroughly that I'm even applying a kind of logical debunking to my own narratives. I guess that that's fair enough. I'm happy with that statement because I'm doing that across the board. But then every now, well, I say every now and then, but actually maybe the first time someone like you's come along, who seems to have had experiences that correspond with the reality, if there is one, that I've not been able to, I haven't been able to save it with the bathwater exactly. I had to risk it. You know, there's so much bathwater that I just like, out it goes. If the baby goes with it, so be it.
Imagine being immersed in the bathwater your whole life and not being able to define it. Process of, okay, what do other people call this? You know, how do other people define this? And then immersing myself in their definitions and going, little bit of that. And then, and all the way to downright, nope, that's not my experience. And then finding, when there are no existing definitions for what you went through, a whole evolutionary kind of process that is still ongoing. You can't throw the bathwater out because there's the majority of the data is in the bathwater, not the narratives. The narratives only get a small amount of it. So it's up to us to redefine ourselves so that we can describe the bathwater or the ether, right? Those liminal spaces, right? If we adapt or adopt these existing narratives, we cut off these other very rich and important streams of information.
Yeah, well, I think it, I mean, we might confuse each other and even listeners, especially listeners, on the metaphor a bit, but I think you're talking about the bath in this analogy. I think the thing that gets saved is the bath, because of course then there's the tap and there's these new streams. So for me, the bathwater does correspond with the narratives. And you're right. you're right. What I did with Whitley Strieber and Prisoner Infinity. Are you familiar with Whitley Strieber, by the way?
I am, from years ago. Just like going, look at his experience. And again, relating and going, I get what he's saying there. I totally get what he's saying. But I didn't have those, real... physical experiences as he had. So yes, go ahead.
Well, that may be one of the keys for sure, this physical thing.
Yes.
I think I've probably forgot the point I was going to finish. Oh, the narratives. Oh yeah, the data. What I do with Prisoner Infinity was keep the data and throw out the narrative, or even use the data to show that the narrative didn't add up. And so gradually the narrative falls away and I'm left with the data. And what the data then told me was, this is trauma. While at the same time, knowing that was another narrative. So I was a nail to drive out a nail. So I couldn't just say it's only trauma. But there's this huge element of trauma that's been either totally de-emphasized and redacted, or it's been inverted into some... in a Stockholm syndrome kind of, let's give a positive spin on it. It was traumatic, but yeah, it was for my own good, which is worse than redacting it, in my opinion. It's distorting it. So yeah, I put that, I tried to rearrange the data so that the traumatic nature of the experiences became central to them. And then that new framework kind of organically rearranged the data for me, writing the book, into a very different narrative, which was much more human-centered. And so I've always had to end up saying, I don't know, there might be transcendental beings in here or fairies or what have you, but there's definitely this element, there's definitely this human manipulation element. So let's just start that, you know, let's strip it back down and get back to that.
Sure.
But as I started to say earlier, or at the beginning, this hasn't, like most of my audience or people I interact with tend to, and my wife who helped me research it, they tend to be very skeptical and very paranoid and very aware and tend to focus on the human manipulation things. So I would say a large number of them do kind of dismiss the whole alien thing just mm-hmm. because there's so much evidence of a deception. And I haven't had many opportunities to, or at least I haven't got much feedback from somebody who, let's say, just for shorthand's sake, is a genuine experiencer of something that can't be reduced to just human manipulation, to see what they think.
Yes.
And who won't just say no to my, because I've met a couple who just say no, it was real. That's all they can see is I'm questioning, right?
And what is real? Define real.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, I'm happy to show up in this space to have this dialogue with you about this.
And maybe we should start there. Like, what sure. happened to you? What I mean, so far as you can turn it into a story or want to.
Sure. You know, it's getting harder and harder for me to go back and retrace my steps and put it all in linear form, because it feels like several lifetimes that I've lived, you know, up to this point in my life. I'm 59 now, and soon to turn 60. And this has been a lifetime process. I remember as a child being very aware of this other kind of communication that I would have that was more real to me than my family, mother, father, and two brothers. And I remember kind of a communion that would occur, comforting, nurturing, kind of preparing me in a way for my life, like informing me, mapping it out in a way. And I do remember talking to my mom and telling her some of these things. And as I hear often from many other experiencers, it's, you know, that's kind of our first introduction to, you know, what's wrong with you? You know, something's wrong with you because you're talking differently than us and you're speaking about things that aren't real, right? And so, and unless you're one of those rare individuals that has a parent or parents that are aware and, you know, nurture, you know, see the value, honor it and nurture it within the child, whatever that might be, whatever their gifts. That was when I've told this story several times before, but I've always been upside down or backwards in my life. So I would know something by essence first and then discover what the definition of it was, what the language was for it. So I would have the experience first, the knowing, and then find out what that was. So a very simple example is my religious mother reading, you know, either the Bible or some kind of children's book, you know, saying, and the angels, this and the angels, and they were full of light, and, you know, and then she, it must have been a children's book because then there was an image, and I went, oh, that's called angel. So I had the word for it. So then I had the language to say, oh, the angels spoke to me again today. The angels came. I was usually out. The strongest memories I have are out in the sandbox on the side of the house. I was kind of a little wild child. It was in the days when you could, you know, have free rein, even as a little girl, to just run around the huge yard at the house and play down. There was a creek that ran behind this particular house where these memories are strong. And, you know, catching pollywogs and playing with the frogs. And I remember stepping gently on the soil in the woodsy areas. And I was a Native American. You know, I knew myself as that. I just had this, you know, I lived in a magical kingdom. And it was extraordinary. So that was the first memories of this sense of more, a greater way to communicate, you know, a different way to communicate, being instantly understood, and instantly understanding through this communion. Then,
did it include a visual or sensory impression?
See, here, this is going to be a key point, I think, in our discussion. I do remember as a child a visual. Now, were they actually standing there at the side of my sandbox? Or was it an internal vision? Because it's so beautiful and so full of light that, you know, and I've experienced this even in recent years. It's like the communion is so powerful that it it's like, yes, it's here, it's present, and I call it presence now. But there's no beings at this stage. It's presence. It's been integrated over all these years as vibration. So in the way that beings manifest throughout my life was that was the first in these interactions that may have been just overwhelmingly in my third eye and feeling them present. And then I think I was about 7 years old when I understood that somehow I was being told that this wasn't going to be a part of my life for a while. And that it's by design. And so, as I, you know, look back in hindsight, then I lived the life as, okay, this is how we begin to contract. This is how we begin to lose the magic and the natural connection with not only these other dimensional beings, but also the natural world. You know, I have since reconnected, you know, with the natural world in that way, but it was extraordinarily magical as a child. You know, there weren't as many filters, right? So the other ways that this manifested is, um, it was inside me. It was through dreams, lucid dreams, out-of-body experiences. Nothing was ever physical. Yikes, there's a being standing in front of me. It's never been in 3D. And this is where I ended up having trouble trying, naively thinking that I could have a voice in the ufology community.
Say, I think you know why. I think you have mentioned the fear component in your experiences.
Yes.
And what I don't know if I picked this up rightly, but there might be a correlation between the fear component and the exteriorization or the concretization of the experience. Is that,
yeah. No, not necessarily. It's when I've spoken about this, you know, to the public in the past, and in my book, when I describe it, It's a distance between the natural state and the unnatural state. And when that rift exists, you know, it's like fear accumulates, the trauma, the fear, the misunderstandings, the, you know, the what the fucks of life, right? Nobody's explaining this, so I'm just disconnected. I'm starting to become a, you know, I'm just a, the soul is not as present as it was, you know, in the child environment that I described. So when that's the case, when this high vibrational presence comes in, however it manifests in my psyche, you know, as a dream, a lucid dream experience, out of body, and I will describe an example of this for you. But I have come to learn that it is that distance and that fear that in the presence of high vibrational intelligence, the fear comes up in a rapid, accelerated way. And then we don't own it. It's just that thing is terrorizing me. Projection, right? And until one remembers that natural state and kind of realigns to it again, which this intelligence helped me do through these interactions. Once that restores itself, at least to a degree, then I was able to hear and connect in this communion way again. I could, and I'm not referring to Whitley Strieber here, I just want to make that clear.
Yeah.
My word communion is my, is not Whitley Strieber's word.
Well, he was a Catholic, so you probably don't mean it in a Catholic way either.
No, I don't. I respect everyone who has, you know, attempted to describe and, you know, translate these experiences. I don't, there's not a judgment there. I'm just saying my word, I don't know, might be different. Different experience than him.
Well, just to interject, you may not know this, that he was, by his own narrative, he was going to call the book Body Terror originally, and then he changed it to Communion.
Yeah. Well, body terror makes sense too. Until, you know, that's the beginning of it. Until you come back to balance, or you return to that natural state. And then I started hearing again and feeling this universal language that comes in pictures, and I don't know, it's just everything all at once. And it's in the body. It's based in the body. It's not, people like to call it telepathy. And I've never been able to align with that word, because it's not like you hear words in your head. It's not like they talk to you. It's feeling, knowing, and resonance. It's like music. To me, it's like music. And then I just naturally started translating it, because I don't need the translation. But if I want to tell another human being about it, I have to translate it, right? So that is, to go back to your question about the fear, or the fear part of it, I will give, do you want to hear an example
sure.
of it? Okay.
Yeah.
I was living in San Diego, California. This was May 1991. And because I have journals, so I recorded all this stuff. I worked for a very large defense company. And I had a secret clearance, and sometimes for special projects, top secret clearances.
This I didn't know about you. Okay.
Well, there are a lot of surprises here. And, you know, that's not even, and sometimes that's relevant, but not necessarily for what I'm going to share with you. This was a really, really high, you know, psychic activity time for me. Strange phenomenon. I've never, by the way, I've never seen a UFO. I've never seen a craft. I've seen unusual movements in the sky, like unexplainable kind of stuff. But I'm not fixated on the sky. It's always been an inner contact. But phenomenon, like what was going on at the time for weeks, what was happening is my things would just come on, you know, electronics would just come on, you know, usually in the middle of the night, like the radio would start blasting, well, depending on what level I had turned it off. Electronics would become activated. And I just kind of started getting used to stuff like that. I would have odd things even happen in my workspace. But on this particular night, sound asleep, and then I woke up into terror, just like no, not even a second to have a thought, you know, it's just, you know, just absolute terror. And what I then thought, my first thought was, someone is here in the room and they're going to kill me. See, so this is how I interpreted the terror. And I'm going to die. And just being, you know, kind of frozen in that terror. And there was nothing I could do because it just makes you, it's just too much. It's too much fear. And then I felt, I didn't see anything, but I felt, the next thing I felt, something like at my feet, like almost as if, you know, someone did this, you know, grabbed my feet and started pulling me down to the bottom of the bed. Now, is this really happening, or am I in a dream? You know, that's just not something that I can say absolutely at this stage, at least. And so I'm pulled down to the bottom of the bed, and now I notice that I'm leaning my back against the bed, and absolutely terrified. And then I decide, I have a thought that I'm going to say the Lord's Prayer, because my mom always used to say the Lord's Prayer, and that, and it's like, well, this is going to save me if I say the Lord's Prayer.
So were your eyes closed the whole time?
Yes. Mm-hmm. So I'm, you know, Our Father, turn to heaven, help me. You know, just kind of mouthing this. And then all of a sudden I felt heard. You know, there's another way for you to experience this. And again, it's not words. You know, there's another way you could experience it. I just knew that this was the message, and it's loud and clear. And I stopped, and then it was pointed out to me that, this next part's going to sound cheesy, but it was pointed out to me that the way I was experiencing it now is with fear. And it was like, well, yeah, I get that. And then it was pointed out that I could experience this with love. And then it was like, what do you choose? It was presented to me, how would you like to proceed from here? Do you want to basically keep staying in this and experiencing it this way? Or do you want to try this other way? That was not present at the time, right? I was responding, reacting in fear. And so it just kept pressing me until I finally just shouted out, love, I want love. And then everything just went and relaxed. I relaxed. I felt this presence just start to build within me. This, like, oh God, you know, this is love. And so I had that contrast there. So I'm not going to jump into the analysis of it afterwards, but I'll stay with the experience. At this point, I'm calm. I know that I'm aware there's something in the room with me, this presence, and it has changed my mind. It has changed my experience drastically. And then I perceive myself floating. And I notice that I'm being floated towards the window. And then I start passing through the window. I'm aware that I'm passing through glass. And I can even feel it, like I have that memory in my feelings that I passed through this glass. And then I'm outside, hovering above my car in the parking lot. This is condos.
So at some point you were able to see, or you opened your eyes, or it became visual.
It became visual, but again, like, what level? Am I really floating outside above my car? Some aspect of me is, right? But not my body, not my physical body. I'm floating there and just noticing that I'm above my car. And then the next thing I know, I'm going just like, it feels like blinding speed somewhere. And then the next thing I know, I'm in space. I'm aware of being in space, like with stars, but it's just like this background. Because then what happened was a whole lot of information. And I remember the visuals of geometry, and that everything could be explained from these geometrical patterns. I can't remember what any of that is. But it's in me. So, you know, this is the experience that has happened so often in my life of downloads, just like feeling like just incredible amounts of data downloading into me. And it's like, well, I guess I'll access it when I need it, you know, is how I have filed that away. And I do end up doing that. So after that happened, the next thing I know, I'm landing back in my bed and my body. And the radio is blasting, you know, as I come back into awareness of my bedroom and my condo, waking up in reality, shared reality with other humans. And it's blasting out, and I become aware that the song, the Pointer Sisters song, I'm So Excited, is playing. And that took me, the humor of that was just, it was just like, wow. Reflected on that quite often over my life. So I get up and I start turning off these electronics that my, you know, remember answering machines?
We have one actually.
Oh, cool. It was like making sounds, clicking sounds and stuff. And my lamp was on, and then the radio's blaring. So I got up to turn the radio off, and I think there was another lamp or something on in the living room. And I went back to bed. My son wasn't there. He was staying with his father on that night. So, but sometimes things like that would happen, and he would be there too, and there would be some interesting crossover experiences sometimes. That was the most, that's the experience that had some physical evidence or markers, you know. But most of that is of the connection, of the communication, was occurring within my consciousness. So I would say more that it was a, you know, some would call that like an abduction experience perhaps, but not in the classic way people refer to it. But to have the electronics.
Sure, that's true. That's a trope. It's true. But I mean, overall, many responses, but one of the most recent responses was, well, why associate that with UFO narratives at all? Because it's so, in a certain sense, it's so far removed, even though there are many overlaps. Yeah,
the only reason, and that's an excellent point to bring up, the only reason that I did put it in that category is because I have had interactions where I saw and was touched by these beings, these very tall, slender beings, right? Now, this is this is in, you know, lucid dreaming, out of body states, right? And so, okay, well, they look different than me. They seem to be other in that way. They seem to have these strange characteristics that aren't human. So, gosh, maybe it's ET. And so then everything becomes, well, I wonder if when they took me out the window, was that ET? You know, you're absolutely right. But here's what I think happens when we have these extraordinary experiences. Is we'd so desperately need to find a place for it. Mm-hmm. Because it takes us well beyond everyday acceptable, you know, normal reality. And we don't have a place to put it. So the mind goes a little cuckoo, you know, crazy. I need a definition. Hurry. Definition. Because I will not be in this space of the unknown. I must put it somewhere. So what happens is an experiencer can have this extraordinary, just this phenomenal opening into the unknown, and then just start searching. Nowadays we have the internet. I didn't have the internet back for a lot of these experiences. So we find what exists, and we go, well, you know, for me, I can only speak for myself. Well, okay, I guess it's that, right? I was speaking of this as we started. Hmm. It's like you just end up accepting whatever, like pick a narrative, you know, is it like pick a card? Is it this narrative, this one? Well, it's this one mostly, and then a little bit of this, and this narrative, existing narrative. So we end up saying, agreeing, okay, that's what it is, so that we can
communicate
and move on, you know, with our so-called lives, right, in this conditioned weird reality, reality gets so extremely weird when you have these experiences. Then you're like, what have we been living in, right? So that's an example of
Right. So, I mean, that's what I was addressing as well, that this thing you're describing is we file it away. We file away the unknown system experience by finding a known category to file it in. So then, of course, we've dismissed it. Ironically, we may have the compensation that we've joined some club and we've found some other people and we can talk to it about, so we can reify it for the identity. But in terms of the actual nature of the experience itself, we've dismissed it because we've categorized it.
Yes, exactly.
So that was what I was describing, where I'm still at, why it's exciting to talk to you potentially, because I could see that I can, well, not recategorize, hopefully, but move out of, like, I had to recategorize my experiences as trauma. I've chosen to do that. I won't say I had to, but I've chosen to. Mm-hmm. Because for many years I was an experiencer, did the quotes there. I didn't go to UFO conventions, but I did discover Whitley Strieber, and I fully identified with him, and he became like a guiding inner voice for me. And so I took on, you know, his narrative is definitely one of the more nuanced within the UFO community, and one of the deep, more profound ones. It's also even more outlandish and crazy, like he sort of spans this spectrum, and it's very tantalizing and titillating and sensational and horrifying and exciting, and so yeah, I was happy to sign up for that identification. I can be like Whitley Strieber, but at a certain point I started to see the holes in the story and realize that this And I suppose the larger context is that this categorization was a dodging. I was really dodging the experiences by categorizing them even as transcendental, like even transcendental as a categorization that prevents transcending, paradoxically. So so that would be the deeper thing, but I was just aware that the story didn't add up as well, which it never will, I suppose. And so I recategorized it. And that did allow me to begin to go into the trauma of my past, because the transcendental narrative didn't. It became a spiritual bypassing, as this, you know, there's a term that gets thrown around nowadays, mm-hmm. but I think mm-hmm. it's quite a good one. That yes. was my cosmic bypassing narrative. Mm-hmm. And so recognizing that at some level that I'd bypassed something meant I don't want to do that anymore. I've got to go all the way, try and go all the way into it. Not that you can really try, but let myself see it if and when I'm ready. So that means I've got to let go of the, you know, draw aside the veils that are preventing me from seeing it. And on those veils are painted these images that make me think it's not a veil. Right? There's nothing behind it.
That's, oh, I like that. Yeah. You know? Yeah.
So the irony of Strieber's screen memories is he's saying, well, I had these screen memories of human interference, but really there are aliens behind it. I flipped that on its head, and I said, well, no, Whitley, what if it's the other way? You've got these terrible human memories, and you've put the screen alien, the alien experience on top of them because they're more bearable. And then on top of that, there's another layer where you forget those things. Mm-hmm. How many layers of the onion are there to our denial?
Mm-hmm.
Well, we're very complex and sophisticated beings,
mm-hmm.
so
mm-hmm.
there are many layers. So while listening to you, the first thing that's really clear is that I could spend just as long countering. I would say, oh well, I've got this experience. I like there's so many correspondences.
Yeah.
So I'll name a couple of them. Okay. One that I was told by a very close and very connected person in my 30s that she had received the felt sense about me that I'd been with the angels until the age of 7.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't remember them my first 7 years. So that's one thing. This encounter that corresponds with something you said, the experience of presence was something that I began to have in my 20s, and this was after reading Whitley Strieber, which is why it was possible for me to later just say, oh well, I was primed. You know, it was incepted in me, and I don't rule that out, of course, because I can't rule anything out. But I had to allow myself to just say, well, maybe none of that stuff was really what I thought it was. But anyway, I had a series of experiences of what you call presence, waking up in the middle of the night with a combination of the sense of a presence in the room with terror, and the terror was what let me know that there was a presence in the room. It wasn't the other way around. It wasn't mm-hmm. I noticed mm-hmm. the presence and felt terror. The terror alerted me to a presence. Yes. And then the corresponding, well, there's one particular experience I had on DMT, which is very close to what you describe, where I encountered a presence arrived in front of me, and I could even see the outline contours of this very dark, heavy, horned kind of presence in front of me, and I felt this terror rising. And then I was saying, "You promise no fear. You promise no fear." and at a certain point, I realized, or I allowed it. It switched over, and I heard that phrase as them saying it to me, you yeah. promised no fear, that I'd promised them no fear. And at that point, or simultaneously with that, the experience shifted from outer to inner, and I was no longer seeing a presence, I was feeling a presence within me, which was like this blue current, this kind of blue snakes flowing through me, mm-hmm. and all the fear vanished, you know, it transformed.
Oh, awesome. So yeah, that's very cool.
Very similar to what yeah. you describe. Huh? Let's just flip it over. Anyway, so there's just been many things you've said that, well, okay, I know that. so this is my life you're recounting here too, or my relationship with this presence is so similar that I've got to acknowledge, I want to acknowledge that.
Yes, I'm so glad you did. I love it. I love this. Okay. So I feel like I have to say at this point, you know, we've gone into this story at certain points. I'm describing these separate kinds of experiences and you as well relating and having similar experiences. Well, I'm inspired to talk about why, what is this about ultimately? Mm. It's about the transformation, the changing of consciousness for me, it's to restore my consciousness. Because after I had that May 24th, 1991 experience, I was leveled. I was flattened. My worldview was completely shattered. It took a long time to, like, the process of putting myself back together again. You know, it's like, well, does this go back in? No, that one's not going to go back in. You know, is this block going to go back in? Yeah, that's still here. You know, and putting myself back together in a different way. I liken it to the 1998 Kundalini experience too, where world view completely shattered. Everything's gone. Okay, what's real now? What are we going to put back together? So I have realized over time and through the experiences that this is about, you know, why me? I don't know. I can't tell you that. Why you? Why other people? And, you know, some people and not other people. I can only speculate about that. But what it did overall in looking back at all these, you know, the nearly six decades, is that it was bringing me back into the natural state. And then not only that, but pulling me forward through, the body and feelings and essence, energy, pulling me into a greater way of being, into we all have to use these phrases, as new age as they sound, but like a new reality, a new world, a new multidimensional way of being. So it's not about ETs. It's not about ETs. It's less about spaceships, because I don't even understand how you can rely on something out there giving you information or communicating with you. I don't trust that kind of communication. Unless I feel it in my core, unless I'm being touched in my feeling body consciousness and communicated and to in that way, then I can't trust what's appearing to communicate to me in the outer world.
See the people looking to the clouds, waiting for the Son of God. And I see the people looking to the sky, hoping he's still alive. And I see the people looking away from the cradle within, the last place on earth they would search for a birth. And all the while, all the while, talking about love, then glare at me, the different one. And from the pulpit, they're talking about the word while the soul is dying to be heard. And I feel the people are longing to be heard, yet so afraid to let go. And I know the people will remember who they are when they bridge the distance to their own hearts. And
yes, I would extend it to, I mean, for example, psychedelics comes to mind. Now, one could say, well, they come from outside too, so that's a good reason not to trust them. And that is my point, is that I don't think we can trust the experiences we have on psychedelics either. However, they do create internally generated experiences, psychedelics. So I think the outside and the inside, I mean, that is a criteria that I use a lot, or have used, in terms of what I can trust. But I think it's not such a clear line, is it, between the inside and the outside?
Well, I can relate to, I took DMT as well, so I have that marker as well. But I didn't figure this out till later. I took the kind of DMT that is, what is it called, 5-MeO?
Don't know.
It's, you don't, you just blast off.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no personalities or beings. There's no one talking to you. It's just pure pure expansion.
Mm-hmm.
And then waking up from that.
Yeah.
And I draw comparisons to the two of the interaction with this presence and the DMT.
Which came first?
The interactions. When I had the DMT experience, the thing that was similar was when I felt it coming on, that it was similar to the fear. It was similar to, I don't think I can take this. And similar to the Kundalini event, I don't think this is going to kill me because it's too big, right? Yeah. So that's similar in each type of experience. So in the DMT experience, I realized there's no going back. I'm in this thing. I can't stop it. I have to move with it, right? So all I remember is saying, yes, 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 yes. Like, if I said no, I would have been dead, is what it felt like.
That's similar to the time I took that kind of DMT. Also, it began with a no, and I realized I was losing my mind, and I started saying no, and it went into hell, and it ended with a yes. Like, the whole trip was me trying to recalibrate that initial no
to get it
into a yes, otherwise, yeah.
Yeah. Oh my God, these parallels are amazing.
Yeah,
I love that. Hearing that, I just wanted to say that destroyed, you know, the worldview too. And that, I would say it took me about, I remember documenting it, it took me about 3 weeks to come back to a, you know, quote, normal state of mind. You know, it had blown out, it felt like it had blown out all these cobwebs or, you know.
Only cobwebs, or do you think it might have blown some other stuff out there that you might not have wanted to blow out?
No, I wouldn't say that. But what I did note was I prefer the natural way. I prefer this, not that people would describe these interactions with interdimensional presence, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah. Well, that's what I was getting to, I think.
Yeah.
Was I don't think it's about in or out. I think it's about whether we're ready or not, which would be determined by a number of factors. Obviously, interference, I mean, trauma is something we're not ready for. It might, like, sexual interference isn't necessarily something bad in its nature, as in sex isn't traumatizing, but if it comes when we're very young, then it's traumatizing. So the same can be true of knowledge, and so obviously psychedelics is an obvious example of something that we can get it wrong. We can say I'm ready and we're not, assuming there's even a natural way to take psychedelics, you know, to awaken, which I question now, but I'm open to the possibility that I just did it wrong, not that the plants are wrong. But that's a clear example of how we might get it wrong. When it comes to intervention from other beings, well, we don't know, do we, if they're beings and if they are and so on. But there's clearly a spectrum of there may be a spectrum, or there clearly is a spectrum, because there are all kinds of beings that intervene in our lives, including the humankind, and it may wake us up, or it may shut us down, or it may wake us up prematurely. So I think that's a key question around this, in terms of if there are other forces that intervene, are they always doing it benignly? So
I don't even know where to jump off, except that there are things that come up. I feel like I have to say this.
Mm.
to go back to, you know, or forward to the integration of this and understanding it, how these, this is all a bunch of pieces of, you know, fragmented pieces of ourselves that we're weaving back together again. And what I learned was that if I faced it and I dialogued with it, that the communion could, I could initiate the communion, and I could dialogue, and keep in mind, I didn't even know Jung and the Red Book existed, because I only had 2 years of college, so I never, you know, really had exposure to, I found these things later, you know, just like, oh, you call it angel? Oh, okay. And so what I discovered when somebody said, well, it sounds like what Jung did, you know, in the Red Book. And it's like, well, what's the Red Book? And then I checked it out from the library and I went, oh my God, I didn't read the whole thing, but initiating that dialogue with other, right? What, in this case, you know, thinking that it's, you know, it appears as ET or otherworldly beings or angels or anything, however you want to define it. What I know now is these are aspects of myself. I'm dialoguing with these pieces of myself that have been put aside because they don't fit here. Mm-hmm. They're not welcome here either in this conditioned reality. We're talking about, you know, the ET phenomenon and experience and all that, but there's so much more to talk about. It's like, there's so many more things that are far more fascinating to me now with, you know, seeing what's happening in this reality, seeing how the human psyche is manipulated and why, how is that done? Well, I have a better understanding of how easy that is to do when you do live with trauma. It's like, hooks can go into trauma and shadow material and hook you into a narrative, an identity, a worldview. And so that's why the more important message for me and my message to others who are interested in hearing is what I learned is that it's absolutely necessary, vital to heal this, all that we've thrown in that chasm, that split within us. And restore this natural connection to source consciousness. Otherwise, you're just going to follow the narrative that you, that hooks you in, essentially. Anyway, I just leapt to, you know, yeah, this happened. It brought me to this space where I can, see and hear and understand from a larger spectrum view what we're in right now and what I was informed we would be in. I knew all of this was coming. I just didn't have the, it's like, it's gonna be a pandemic. No, I didn't. I knew that we were going to come into a time where we would all be in this fear place, you know, fear, the higher vibrations are saying, hey, what's your choice? You know, basically boils down to what I experienced and what you say that you have experienced as well. It's like these pivotal moments where markers within our being that said, this is important. This is, it's not about outer markers anymore. It's about finding those inner markers where it's like, oh yeah, I remember the choice between love and fear and what that felt like. So then when you come to that place again, you can go, oh yeah, I remember, you know, that inner marker is there. And you go, yeah, I'm going with love. I'm going to go with the energy of love. And I feel it's in this direction. You know, when we have these, we come to these forks in the road,
mm-hmm.
these choices.
Are you aware of trauma in your own childhood at all?
Yes.
Are you aware of events?
I've done a lot of work.
So are you aware of events or just the body that you've found in your body or both?
Events.
Yeah.
Yeah. There was sexual trauma that actually began, I would say, 8, 9 years old. And then there was my direct experience of abuse in my late teen and 20s. My direct experience of narcissism.
Mm-hmm.
My direct experience of feeling like a victim. I use the word direct experience because I've come to find out that these extraordinary experiences, we call it a direct experience of the divine, I've also had the direct experience of the shit, the trauma, and the direct experience of healing, consciousness around it, bringing, you know, facing that terror, you know, repeatedly in order to heal it and transcend it.
Hmm.
And that came in a variety of forms. The trauma work was I guess the first I went to a healing school, a 3-year healing school in San Diego. Energetic healing. And we did a lot of this in more intense work with trauma. And also I'm trying to remember all of the different the most recent was when I had gone to attend an event in 2015, and my abuser was there at that event.
From which age?
Late teens. Hmm. I was, people would ask me, "What were you getting? Is that going to be all right?" You know what? Yeah, yeah. I was really sure of myself. Like I've done so much healing work and therapy, and you know the works, that I'm fine. Well, this is when I discovered the deeper body component. Because when I got back from this event, traveled to and back, I started having anxiety attacks and panic attacks. I've never had that in my life. I was like, this is weird. And I told a friend who was a therapist, and she said, well, it sounds like, you know, there's some trauma work there. And why don't you call this place? And so I got an appointment at a place, and this is when I lived in Santa Fe. And anyway, I discovered that I wasn't done with that trauma, and that the body was shouting at me to pay attention to it. And I did brain spotting.
What's that?
Wow. Okay, so the guy or the people who developed EMDR kind of branched off into brain spotting, and the therapist started with EMDR with me, quickly moved to brain spotting, and I do not have enough good things to say about it. It is absolutely amazing. You can actually feel, well, I have the sensitivities to feel it, but to actually feel it, leave or disperse or
the trauma.
Yeah, it's very powerful, the energy of it leaving, or and then feeling the influx of the openings that can occur, and then this is what I found out more that this is when that the body is an instrument. It's a musical instrument, and the more open it is, like the body of a cello or guitar, this is how communion works best. When this is the cavities are open, there's not the blocks, and you start to feel the resonance, the music of this communion. But we don't hear it or feel it or see it. It doesn't even exist if we're walking around with this trauma. Yeah.
So how does it work then, the brain spotting?
It seems, so simple, like, well, how could that work? But it does. They have like a pointer, like a metal pointer that they take. Your eyes follow the tip of the pointer, and they're trained to as your eyes follow the pointer, they're trained to really observe your body and what and very subtle things that happen with your eyes. I think the basic understanding I have of what happens is the therapist will notice, they know what to look for. So they'll stop and they'll inquire. And, you just, as the client, you're just feeling it, breathing into it. And then they'll say, "What? Can you give me any impressions here, or just anything?" And it's very, very casual. And usually something would emerge, but apparently, at the time that the trauma happened, your eyes were in this position, and so it's an indicator of how the body stores.
Like a dial, like a memory dial in the eyes. It's probably related to something that Dave O'Shaughnessy talks about and does, which is clearly observes the eyes, because he mentions this sometimes, that he's noticed that when people say "I don't know," or they get blocked, or they're trying to express or find something, or they're stuck in some way, that their eyes are pointing a certain way, and he suggests that they point their eyes because he senses that the thing that they're saying they don't know, or the thing that is sticking them is the opposite way to where their eyes are. So in other words, they're actually unconsciously trying not to see the very thing that consciously they're trying to see.
That makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I understand. I did my best to explain what I know about it, but I'm no expert on it. I experienced it, and I experienced the results of it, and I did find that eye position it is a very profound, a very profound feeling. But I'm just kind of, I notice subtle things. That's just my nature. So I was probably a good student client for that experience. I don't know if it would work for everybody, but I recommend it.
Presumably everybody is doing this thing. I mean, and we're unconsciously, we would be picking it up about each other when we're communicating, what our eyes are doing, and what our whole bodies are doing, how congruent it is with what we're saying or expressing. In terms of how real or how authentic the communication is, essentially. Yeah.
I don't know if I'd be able to break it down into, body language, like, look, they're doing that, so that means that. But I do know when somebody's lying. I know when somebody's being inauthentic. I know when somebody's afraid. I know, even as a child, it was overwhelming to people because I knew what their fears were. And I knew when they were speaking and when they were telling a lie, I would call it out and say, but that's not true. You feel this way. And, I wasn't very popular
at right.
family parties. And then, of course, carried that into my work now and my life now. Of, are you familiar with astrology?
Mm-hmm.
I'm very Plutonian with my work.
Pluto first house.
Ruling sign Pluto. Mm-hmm. Conjunct the 10th house, the midheaven. And the north node, conjunct the north node. Which I learned, a few years ago about North Node evolutionary astrology. I'm not an astrologer, but I was around it a lot. So I kind of picked up a lot by osmosis over the years.
Mm-hmm.
And I use it as a tool now for, here's what I'm getting, here's what I'm feeling, here's what I'm tapping into with this communion when I inquire, and then going to astrology and especially about feeling like, okay, something's coming up. We're going to be feeling this. This is going to happen, not particulars, but landscapes, and potential in these landscapes, individually and collectively. And then looking at astrology and going, oh, that's fascinating that, this planet is an aspect to this one, or it's personal, it's an aspect to, it's transiting this or that in my chart. And so having these validating tools has always been very important to me.
So I want to ask you a question now, and I'll throw the question and then I'll give the context or what else I want to say. The question is something like, what's your sense of the relationship between your past trauma and your experience of the of the divine, let's say, just to keep it short. And I want to, before you answer, I also want to, rather than going to what you already have worked out about this, because I think it is part of your presentations and stuff, because I saw that that you bring trauma into it. Can you answer from right now, and in terms of what maybe what you pick up is going on with me, so that it's a very time specific answer? Because and I'll add a little bit extra more. Like I feel like I might be seeing something around this for you, but I might not be. I might just be projecting it, because it's definitely part of my understanding of the relationship between the divine and trauma. Is I think quite probably different from yours. So I'm interested if we can meet, you know, or we are meeting, and yeah, how much we have different pieces of the same puzzle.
Yeah, that's I need you to narrow it down. I just don't even know where to go from that question. It's too vague for me.
Okay.
I want.
Okay, so I'll narrow. Okay. I'll narrow it down.
Okay.
Do you feel? Have you observed? Or what do you feel about the possibility that your experiences of trauma have shaped your relationship with the divine, or to some extent determined it, or even created it?
I have never ever framed it that way. Mm-hmm. So that's why I'm just like, you know, like, if I were a dog right now, you'd be seeing my head cock.
Uh-huh.
First off, are we not all traumatized? Are we not all, just by being born into this place, shoved out of our core, shoved out of our center, abused by this false reality with a bunch of false personas and stories? And I mean, it's all very traumatic, this place. And I don't mean to diminish anything that you experienced or even my own experiences. But I guess it would help me hone in to hear about what kind of trauma, whatever level that you're comfortable with, to talk about. Like, what was it that you felt connected or led you to the divine connection? What is that process?
You mean as relating to trauma?
Yes.
Well, first the thing is I don't remember what happened in my childhood. I don't remember those first 7 years that I was supposedly with the angels. What I do know is that the angels didn't protect me from human interference.
I see.
And nor would I expect them to.
Yeah.
I mean, I didn't mean that. It might sound like an expression of disappointment, but
damn,
it wasn't meant to. But to me, they're not. It's not contradictory that I might have been in the presence of angels and at the same time terrible things might have been happening. This is theoretical, but this is based on my understanding of Whitley Strieber's work. There might be a relationship between them. In other words, that I had to take refuge with the angels because of what was going on in my environment was so terrible. Or even that they did rescue me in some way, but they didn't physically rescue me, which is, that's Whitley Strieber's story. I just simply don't know. What I've got in my memory banks is, you know, in terms of my present, my adult pursuits of the divine, are that they were very trauma induced, as in I did a lot of psychedelics. I gave up my money and went off to Morocco to live on the streets, and even in fact it killed me. Did extreme breathing and meditation and shamanic rituals and all kinds of stuff that was the attempt to bootstrap that expression, you know, to storm heaven is the phrase that I've used more recently, taking it from the gospel, that you can't enter the kingdom of heaven by storm, because the kingdom of heaven is within the body. So all the things I was doing to the body to try and re-experience or re-access an experience of the divine natural state were taking me further from it. They gave me the illusion that I was reconnecting to it because of that dissociative mechanism that I'd learned, which is that, you know, if my body's in a state of extreme intensity, then my consciousness will disassociate into these other realms, and so I'll have visions and the rest of it,
whether it's
astral projection and so on.
I see.
But what was happening to the body was just getting more shit put into it, more interjections, and more stress on the nervous system.
Yeah.
So this is the thing that I've been sort of feeling while we've been talking today. This is the relationship between fear and our encounter with the divine, and what that element of fear is, and is the fear really a response to the divine, or is it that the fear's in the body and that's prevented us from accessing the divine because it's preventing us from being in our own body?
Yes.
And so then, well, it seems to me there are some experiences that are dissociative and some that are grounding and embodying, and I can't tell the difference. I mean, I'm learning to for my own self, but with others, it's very hard for me to tell because they sound the same in words. Possibly.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay.
Cross my
so the terror was, you know, going back to, you know, whatever the fear, the trauma is that we carry, it is coming to the surface. It is saying, this must be dealt with. This is what blocks you from embodying this. Mm. And it's always been about that. Always, for me. It's always been a feminine centered body experience. So when I talk about out of body experiences, those are interesting ways, and they were interesting ways at the time, to have an interaction. But everything has led me to what you say at the end of part four in your interview. I knew it would come back in.
Right.
Resonance there. That we are being poked and prodded and shaken and, you know, like, wake the fuck up now and return to your body. Hmm. Return to the full spectrum of your natural design of consciousness now. Like, now. Because there's like an opening, there's like an opportunity now in this, when we bring in the Mayan science and the Mayan calendar, you know, this in-between worlds space. I'm not saying this because the Maya said it. I'm saying, I feel this, I know this, I am guided to this. And look, the Mayan calendar lines up with this, and the Hopi calendar, you know. And other calendars that say we are in between worlds, we're coming into the next sun. So there's a the image that's given to me quite often when I'm being shown what's happening now, and like in this interesting in between time, is that we're in this fog right now, and it was, let's say it was brought on or caused by COVID. We can point to COVID-19 and say, look what COVID-19 did. It doesn't really matter. We're all being pushed now into our selves. It's like, you can't go anywhere. You can't perpetuate that old life and identity. I mean, world. Trying, I guess a lot of people are trying, but really it's about being taken off the rails of that old world and reality. And we're in this potentiality now, where all that I see, the images that I'm shown in these connections is there's all these train tracks, which I also call narratives. It's like all these trajectories and narratives and stories just going off in all these different directions inside this fog. And it's like, what do you choose now? I've translated this as, this is the choosing time. What do you choose now? And from what layer of consciousness? How much are you embodying? What are you choosing from? Are you choosing from full knowing? And then at that point, you're not even choosing. It's not like it's a mental process or anything. You are just pulled forward into something greater. Or you go with the narratives that you're given, the mind control, the this or that, right? The, well, are you red or are you blue? And speaking about America right now. Mm-hmm. Who's the devil and who's the angel? And, you know, it's just pure insanity that all of this theater is keeping people stuck in between two narratives. Mm-hmm. So that you can't find your way out of the fog. You can't bring anything else in because, again, the mind is going, oh, what do I pick? What do I pick? What do I pick? I'm scared. I got to go with something, because you're not anchored in anything greater. That's just an idea or a concept to you. It's not embodied. It's disembodied. So you go with what your family goes with, or, you know, whatever influences mm-hmm. you have. And we're being poked and prodded here because that trauma, that shadow, it's incredible. It's amazing how well it works to twist the consciousness, the mind, the thinking, and pull it into these narratives.
Because it just reminded me of something that I heard you say, actually, on the, I think you sent me a link, or no, I found it at your website, but it was, you said something about how because some of us are withdrawing our attention more and more from the theatre's breaking down, I'm paraphrasing, and mm-hmm. that's why there's so much confusion and chaos and polarity in the world, because some of us are not giving our energy right. and attention to it as much as we were before. So the more that, I mean, I'm extrapolating now, the more that we withdraw our attention and become centered in ourselves, the more rooted we get. In a certain sense, the more things go to hell outside of us.
And the more we're carried into, or we create this together, and I'm going to come back to what I said to you when we first started talking. I love your work. I love what you are doing, because you're having dialogues with people who are experiencing more of a spectrum, right? Just more there, and they're exploring, they're discussing, they're willing to commit to embodying and being this, right? And the more that we have these conversations, the more real this becomes. And then it's hard to translate, but what I've been shown is that, you know, New Agers will call this ascension, but it's not anything that I've read, you know, when I perused that topic and word. It's an ascension in, you know, who do we choose to be when we embody this divinity that we are? That's not New Age rhetoric. That is actual. That is the grounded stuff. There's more terror of being embodied, more fear around that than just staying safely in the community of narratives, you know, every echo chamber reinforcing each other that, well, we're so spiritual. Or even, you know, religiously, you know, with the the rapture, right? Mm-hmm. And that some people think that this is all being accelerated into, so they can hurry up the rapture, you know, and bring about the apocalypse, and I don't know, whatever their narratives are.
Well, I think that one person's concept isn't can be another person's felt sense, and that we have many different, and it's not a hierarchy. It's not like I might have a felt sense of something that for you is conceptual and vice versa. And that's part of, I think, the meaning of these dialogues. For me, I've got a lot of Saturn in my chart.
So do I.
And for me, I want to see the rubber hit the road. I want to actually
Yeah.
feel the traction of the real. And of course, the real isn't just the mundane, but and the body itself isn't just mundane, but it does have that. I mean, that's the most tangible layer of it is, what's physically tangible, what can we encounter and grapple with. And you mentioned the New Age a number of times today as a disclaimer, like I'm this might sound New Age, but it's not. So that speaks to this, that you feel that you do have a felt sense of things that unfortunately people out there are talking about without any felt sense of or any experience of. Not don't want to cast pearl or whatever, I mean stones and living in a glass house or whatever, but it's just the truth. And that diminishes the currency, and that does a lot of harm. Is if we try and wrestle with realities at a conceptual level before we have a direct experience of them, we think maybe that it'll help us get to the experience of it, but it probably won't, because we're so adept at building these castles in the sky.
Yeah.
And I think that this speaks to what I haven't yet been able to get to around trauma and the fear, and that, and one and certainly central to my whole how I had to reject Whitley Strieber. It wasn't that what he was saying was bullshit. It's that, as you just said about the place we choose from, the place that he was communicating these things from was not rooted in a wholesome interaction with them. They had become a kind of dissociative mind candy.
Yeah, I hear you. Yeah.
And I have that tendency, and it's possible that you don't to anywhere near the same extent. I'm quite close to Whitley Strieber, but that's why I ended up enmeshing with him and having to take down his fiction in order to liberate myself from it. So I'm going to pull back from things that you say, and I'm sure you felt it. For this reason, not because I'm skeptical of you, but because I'm skeptical of my own inability to relate to these th certain things at a conceptual level. And one of the ways, or rather to relate to them, I don't want to relate to anything at a conceptual level unless I have to. So I'm skeptical of my own experience around these things. And so one of the ways that for me to, he's saying bring it back to the body, which, as you know, I'm very much in accord with. One of the ways that I find myself orienting is to the personal, actually. That, and you've got this phrase translating infinity, which is similar to incarnating infinity. We are the word, I guess you could say. That's the only, it seems to me that's the only way that it works. Like the universal has to become the personal, but that's what roots it, just as the infinite can only incarnate in the finite. Otherwise there's no incarnation, right? It's everywhere and nowhere. So yeah, my tendency is to always want to reverse the trajectory from the big cosmic down to the minutiae, not as a way to avoid the cosmic, but as a way to root it. Because of all my I've been so, I took to the infinite like a fish to water, but I put it in the quotes. If it wasn't the real infinite, because if it was, I'd be swimming free right now, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So I have to keep dialing it down. So, for example, one of the first things you say I wanted to come back to, so now I will, was you being 59 and you having two brothers. Well, my sister's 59, and we were a family, you know, two brothers and a girl, you know, so that there's like, oh, there's probably some really specific nitty-gritty personal correspondences between us. And this is also something that I discovered when I was looking at Whitley Strieber's experiences, was that, and I'll try and sum it up briefly, that he was having these experiences with who knows what, a combination of CIA with the transcendental or the divine or the extra-dimensional, somehow those two things working together. And they were... let's say even the degree to which there was some higher dimensional presence that was teaching him or trying to lead into expansion, what I observed, and he kind of communicated without knowing it, but they were reenacting family dynamics for him. And so there was something in his own personal past around his family that he was unconsciously trying to resolve. And these beings, if there were such a thing, or this presence, was trying to help him with. But what I kept seeing when I looked over it was he kept saying, no, no, it's not that, it's not my family, it's not my mother, it's over here, it's the visitors, and they're taking it. And he just kept going to the cosmic thing, and thereby missing that his real work was in the mundane and in the personal. And so I think he became very disembodied. The more he had these experiences, the more he wrote about them and reified them and narrativized them, the less embodied he became. So that has made me acutely aware of this risk.
I see what you're saying. Yes. And I have been witness to that phenomenon as well in talking to experiencers.
Yeah.
There's almost like a need to, you know, to build this new identity, to, you know, to set up camp and find a way to be forward, instead of continuing to move with it, because it will. It for me, what I learned through the interactions is, it actually does want to take you to those places. It's our resistance of us and our spinning off into, you know, needing to create a new narrative or story or identity. What we were talking about before, about finding a way to be with it, with an existing narrative, instead of staying with it and engaging with it and going into that deeper inquiry, rather than I'm going to go with this, you know, but you can feel it. See that when I have spoken to some experiencers, I notice the, more of an embodied, experience, that they have been, accepting the invitation to do this dance, and to, because it's a healing process. If you continue with it and you participate in it and you own it, like, okay, here's what's real. This is one of the tools that I was given through this process, through this evolution, is, you know, what's real right now? So it's like this emotional awareness tool. Well, what's real? What are you feeling? What are you feeling right now? And then finding that in your body, honestly, and then speak it honestly. And this was what they quotation marks always when I say they, because language is not my friend, I say often. When you bring it back to the body and feelings, and you speak the truth from where you are, you have less tendency to go into story and spin off into fantasy, because it's like, what's here right now? What's actual? So it's like starting right where you are with what you feel, and then practicing speaking it out honestly. And that's the attunement. That's when you start to hear your own voice speaking the truth. Your body will then start to go, That's not true. Try again. Right. You know, so then you drop back down in and, you know, all right. So what I'm feeling is this. And then the body, you know, will tell you how accurate you are with that. So the practice is to speak the truth and what is actual and real right here, right now. Very Saturnian in a way, but also we're working with emotions, which is something that we haven't been encouraged to do in this reality.
Yeah, I was just remembering that you mentioned that in the talk I watched, and that's another correspondence with things that Dave talks about. It's the essentiality of receiving the information of our emotions and allowing them to allowing it to be expressed, communicated.
Yes, this is what you know. What was taught to me through this communion, it's like it was a call and response from within me. It said, you know, what are you feeling? And I just. Yeah, initially was like, wait, what? Because I was meditating. And anyway, this all unfolded out of this dialogue of call and response. And then learning how to tell the truth. Because we all think we're telling the truth, right? We just, you know, yeah, I tell the truth.
Yeah, I've prided myself on my honesty, and I have to say, listening to that lecture when you said that about lying all the time, and because it came at a particular time in my life of self-doubt, not that every day isn't an opportunity for self-doubt, but it's been particularly strong recently, I really reconsidered, okay, well, so there's honesty and honesty, right? But of course I'm lying to myself all the time. I have an identity, and that's its job.
Yeah.
A false identity.
Yeah. This practice took me to whole new layers of understanding about what we're doing here, what we're agreeing to, what we just assume is reality. I'm always a little, you know, I listen to you carefully when you talk about, you know, bringing it back to what's real. It's like, well, it's like, well, what's real? Please define real, because so many people think that, you know, this is the context that we're working with, and that we, sure, natural world, I'll give you that, but this thing that we've created, this reality, is not real. It's all based on falsity. It's foundationally false. And thank God we have the natural world here with us. Otherwise, wow. But see, that would take us in to the next episode of transhuman technology and those trajectories, because I've seen these things.
Which things?
Transhuman technology. The moving, hurting human consciousness.
Completely away from the natural world.
Yes, yes. And completely, this, some of the other things you touched on in when I mentioned the end of part four, was that if we're not here, if we are not embodying, if we're not in our bodies, if we're not owning who we are, if we have not found our inner authority, our divine authority, then we will continue to surrender whatever is left and say, I don't know anything here. Mm-hmm. You want, yeah. Oh yeah, I want to be smarter. Hook me up, right? Mm-hmm. It's only trying to, all that can be done in the outer world is be a symbol or stand for something that you're already connected to, that you already are. You already are that power. And you're being convinced that you need what is being offered to you from the outer world in the form of technology. Technology's not bad, but as I've written about a lot, unless you're in your body, interacting with, you know, these technologies, it doesn't go to a good place. Let's just put it that way. If we're disconnected from ourselves and this technology blends with us, that's all that dystopia stuff. But if we are in our bodies fully, then we have this symbiotic kind of relationship with technology. We do, it's a dance. I've had dreams of being shown, you know, like one I was shown, they asked me to open my hand up and they laid a glove on top of it and it started to move and connect with me. And it was like, it was an archer. And this is too much to explain, but it was this very specialized glove for where I was and who was talking to me, the environment that I was in. And it stopped, and it basically stopped and wouldn't meld with me because I wasn't an archer, which is what this glove was designed for. And then all these people around me just started chuckling. It was a joke. It was humorous. They wanted to show me how the technology worked and how it would not meld with me because that was not my purpose, or that's not, it didn't have any use with me. We didn't have any use for each other. So that was a very long, confusing explanation, but I can't really give the whole dream to give context. But I have had several dreams where I'm interacting with technology. And when you're whole and you are embodied and you are present and fearless, you know who you are. Technology can, yes, definitely blend with us, sentient, you know, technologies. But if we surrender ourselves to more outer world manipulation, you do not want to see that happen without being embodied.
Well, although I can be open to the idea of sentient technology and that the gods or fully evolved humanity or our true selves or however we want to call that might still have technology of a very different order, all of that is conceptually acceptable to me. It's very conceptual. I've had not very similar dreams, but close enough. And so, therefore, for me, what seems to be central to my choosing who to be is leaving all of that. Well, not all of it, but reorienting myself to nature and to the possibility, and the challenge of going back 300 years in time and just living with nature without any of that stuff. Not as a renunciation, but as a, because I probably won't renounce it. I mean, hopefully I'll still be having these conversations and the technology will still be available and I won't be getting enslaved by it. But I mean, as a consent or an assent to, yes, I'm willing to give up everything to restore my natural self to me, or to to give myself back to nature. And that, I mean, that's a huge choice. I mean, we're actually trying to engineer this move currently from BC to Spain and then get a property in Spain in nature and develop some sort of farm life there. You know, who knows how it's going to go, but it's a huge choice, pulling out roots and then taking a chance and committing to a kind of life that I've never tried before and I think will be very difficult and uncomfortable. But it also seems to me that it's relatively small compared to what you're touching on today in terms of making the right choice, in quotes, because as you said, it's not a mental choice. but being willing to surrender to the right forces as opposed to the wrong forces, and really let go of my attachments. And just to finish this thought, this what I've become more aware of this week is this extends not just to technology or Netflix, it extends to the whole illusion that there's a reality outside of me. And this seems to be the crux of this they, why the word they is so pernicious, because my need to get support outside of myself, ever since I couldn't get it from my parents and my caregivers, so strong, so crippling, because it's both a symptom of and preventing me from connecting back to my core source of transmission. And of course it will project onto everything, you know, to the gods themselves. So it's like the idea of a they that's going to help me, these beings that I feel I've encountered, is so intoxicating. I just know that's the wrong orientation for me, even though that may be a truth, that they, why not? Why shouldn't the gods manifest it? You know, why not? But my orientation has to be inward.
Of course it does. Yeah. And when I speak of the dialogue, I'm not, I wouldn't even, I myself don't call it the gods or something beyond me.
Yeah.
It is an aspect of me that I have disembodied, that I have sent away. And so it's basically, you know, reintegrating that. So it begins, what I was shown was the dialogue is ever helpful in bringing the truth into, you know, front and center, and feeling it and saying yes, 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 you know, to say yes to the merging of this. Because one of the things that I just want to say too, that it's so important that we choose to fill ourselves back in with who we are, with all of who we are. And that's what informs us moving forward. It's, we don't even have to think anymore, or like, what, you know, should I do this or should I do that? You just are doing it, right? And if we don't do that, then others will fill us in. They will fill it in for us. That's what we've been doing. We allow people to fill it in if we don't choose to fill it in ourselves with what's true and actual and whole about who we are in our original design. So that's, I just wanted to, if we're wrapping up, I just wanted to make sure that I got that in.
I think we are wrapping up, actually. It's, I just checked, it's 2 hours and it's about to turn 3:33 at my end.
Yeah, that just went by. It felt like 5 minutes to me. So that's how much I enjoy it. And that's how much I appreciate you inviting me to dialogue with you. It's total joy, and keep doing what you're doing. As long as it's joyful to you, as long as you get something out of it. But I just think this service is so wonderful. I read some of the comments in one of the previous episodes you did that said, and I even expressed it sort of this way. It's like, we feel like we're there with you, you know, we're like I had said, I'm like a fly on the wall. I get to just absorb what happens in these honest, more deeply, you know, conscious conversations that we're having. And it helps to demonstrate for others how this is done, right? I mean, a lot of people have to have this demonstrated to see that this is, this is a way, this is a way that we could encourage, you know, to have these kinds of really present conversations. So thank you for doing this.
Well, you're welcome. I said recently, or realized recently, that even as a kid, I always wanted one-to-one dialogues. Like I always wanted just to be talking to one person. So consciously or unconsciously, a bit of both, I've contrived a space for me where I can have these. And as you know, as you probably observe, I very rarely do interviews. I don't. It takes the relax out of it. I mean, the more comfortable I feel with the person that we can just hang out and talk and connect, the better it tends to go.
Yes, it's magical.
Yeah, and I would agree. I mean, that is something that what you just said, was something I became conscious of as I started doing this podcast, and the times we're in, that actually just two or more people having a conversation is a rare thing these days. Something's happened to us that
well, there's a lot of conversations. There's so many podcasts out there, but I have found very few that are on this level. So I it was important for me to make sure you knew that this is very special, and it's a gift. And this is, you're being of great service right now.
Well, thank you.
Yeah,
I do want to hear that. I want to accept that, receive it, take it, and not deflect it in an English way of, oh no.
Good. Good. Take that in. So thank you.
That's the end of this week's The Liminalist, my conversation with Eileen Mayer. If you'd like to find out more about her, listen to her songs, find out what she's up to, you can click on the link in the show notes, go direct to her website. Next week's Poddy Podcast is with Alexander Adams. Don't miss it.
Dream your dreams into ether and in the clouds. Nothing lasts, hardware is gone. We're all just clouds. Life moves fast, we'll drink the